it's pretty clear that the mind of Mr. Bush is made up and he's going to war. It's a matter of how and when and if the UN is with him or if it's not.
The media is not serving their consumers or the American public accurately and responsibly.
The United States has started to be more aggressive and is using the cover of enforcing the no-fly zone to prepare for attacks upon Iraq.
I don't think that there are people in Iraq who harbor great hatred or would ever want to attack people in the United States.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, November 7th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Emboldened by Tuesday's election results, which the White House interprets as a mandate for Bush's policies, the Bush administration is pushing ahead with a UN vote on its resolution to attack the people of Iraq. A man who spent over three decades of his career in high-level positions at the UN but quit 4 years ago out of frustration says the resolution is geared towards Bush's war. Dennis Halliday is former UN Assistant Secretary General. Mr. Halliday, what's your impression of the latest resolution?
Well, the good news is we've seen, I think, Mr. Bush and Washington listening happily to Europe and to the Arab states and allies and friends and modifying its position. It seems to indicate clearly that the unilateralist approach of attacking Iraq has been put on the back burner, that Mr. Bush is willing to work through the United Nations. Now, at the same time, he's threatening the United Nations through this draft resolution, which says, basically, let's put a lot of pressure on the Iraqis. If they don't comply, if there's any indication of lack of cooperation, that will trigger something else, and something else, as I guess we sadly know, is war. And whether that war is under UN's umbrella or whether it's a unilateral U.S. war, it's bad news, and in my view, it's unjustified, and it's a dangerous maneuver for everybody, including the United States.
And what about the term specifically? Have you been following, the recent actions, blow by blow, term by term? Is there anything in that resolution that you think might specifically trigger Saddam Hussein?
Well, it calls for, in the minutiae of the resolution, very specific cooperation. Any indication of a failure on the part of the Iraqis to open the door, to be there in the middle of the night, to stand back, to do all the things that they may find have difficulty doing, in that Iraq is still a sovereign state. That seems to indicate that the head of UNMOVIC, Hans Blix, will report to the Secretary General, to report, to the Security Council, and that may then trigger military action. So we're going to be very close, it seems to me, to the edge at all times, because in this situation, it's going to be extremely difficult, this operation in Iraq, to start over again since the end of 98. And I fear we will be easily tripped up in deliberately or not deliberately, and that may end up in a military invasion. And, you know, when you see, I was in Shannon Airport yesterday in Ireland. I watched several hundred U.S. troops pass through Shannon Airport on their way to, I believe, Kuwait. It's pretty clear that the mind of Mr. Bush is made up, and he's going to war. It's a matter of how and when and if the U.N. is with him or if it's not.
Which sort of leads me to my next question. Do you see this latest U.N. resolution as an opportunity to try and really create or foster peace in the region, or as I've seen it described in one report, as a menu of excuses to wage war with Iraq?
I agree with that latter observation. This is not about peace. This is about threatening one state, and there are many states who violated resolutions, but we're only focusing on one. And we're threatening it to such an extent that its sovereignty is endangered, it's already under threat, it's already being bombed by the United States, and its head of state is being threatened with overthrow. You put this together, I think that's a formula for failure, and I think that's exactly what Mr. Bush wants. I think the pressures to go to war are now tremendous on him and the Pentagon, and that's a tragedy for everybody concerned.
You're familiar with the inner workings of the UN. Many people throughout the world are sort of holding out hope that France and Germany and China were going to hold the line and prevent the United States from basically having its way around this UN resolution. What do you suppose happened?
Well, The United States is the world's superpower. The United States has tremendous influence on issues outside the UN, whether it's IMF or the WTO. And Russia and China and France, they all need various forms of cooperation. Maybe it's IMF money. Maybe it's negligence on the part of Washington vis-a-vis Chechnya, which suits Putin and so on. The Chinese want, you know, trade, and they've got their WTO membership. Everybody wants something, and U.S. often can provide it. So it's all about something else. And the reality then of the Security Council is, sadly, that it's a compromise not in the best interest of the U.N. or international law or the people of Iraq, but in interest of the states concerned, the five permanent members.
It kind of makes you wonder, what is the purpose of having the UN? Is it still serving a credible purpose in this world as we know it?
Well, the fact that it's not perfect and the fact that it's dominated by five members with veto power doesn't mean we can afford not to have it. I think we'd be at a huge loss. I think the opportunity to meet, to talk through the General Assembly, to have a responsibility in the Security Council is important, and I can think of many ways to improve it, and many others more able than I have proposed changes and reform, but we do need the United Nations, and this great country, the United States of America, also needs the United Nations and needs to work with international law and not, as we've seen in the last, 18 months, snubbing its nose at all aspects of international law with, I think, very dangerous consequences for the United States and for the rest of us.
Dennis, you've witnessed firsthand the kind of repressive rule that Saddam Hussein has imposed upon the people of Iraq. What, in your opinion, is the best way to serve the interests of the Iraqi people while preventing Saddam Hussein from imposing any threat to the U.S. or its neighbors in that region, if, in fact, you feel that he does pose a threat?
Well, I think the threat is greatly exaggerated for political reasons. I think the answer, and I'm in favor of regime change, for example, but that is a decision that can only be made by the people of Iraq. They must do that. And we've seen how that happened in Indonesia. We can certainly see it happening in Iraq. But as long as the embargo is in place, we have crushed the people of Iraq. We've strengthened the government of President Saddam Hussein. We've done exactly what we perhaps didn't intend to do. And we are punishing collectively the innocent people of this country who were not involved in invading Kuwait, were not involved in weapons of mass destruction of any sort. Why are we punishing them? This makes no sense. So we need to end the embargo, try to get some sort of participatory government into Iraq is what is, I think, the Iraqi people would want themselves. And they will take care of the sort of governance that they want in their time when they're ready to do that. And that's their business. It's not ours. It's not the business of Mr. Bush.
The administration alleges that Saddam Hussein attempted to assassinate the first president, George Bush.
Yes, I find that outrageous. But, you know, the first Mr. Bush attempted to assassinate Saddam Hussein, as I call. He bombed Baghdad, was it for 2 months or 100 days, killing who knows how many hundreds or thousands of civilians, and I believe deliberately tried to flatten the number of the palaces or wherever they thought the president of Iraq was residing. So this is just tit for tat. There's nothing unusual, sadly, about this sort of games being played between countries who are aggressive and armed.
Okay. Dennis, any final thoughts on your part?
Well, I'm in favor of a dialogue. I mean, we have to remember Saddam Hussein was a friend and ally of the United States. When it suited us, he fought the Iranians. We gave him intelligence. We gave him money, as you know, under Mr. Reagan. Donald Rumsfeld himself went to Iraq in 83 and 84, met with Saddam Hussein to bring Iraq closer to the United States. We should remember that and our responsibilities in the situation today. Open that dialogue, end the embargo, and then demand the end of arms manufacture and sales to the entire Middle East, as per Resolution 687. We have a lot of work to do, and so do the Iraqis. I mean, they've got to address their human and rights issues, their rights, civil and political rights issues. But we, the United Nations, the United States, have got to address the fact that we, through the embargo, have destroyed the fundamental human rights of the Iraqi people, housing, education, employment, health care, and for thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of children and adults, we've taken away their lives, and that has got to end.
Thank you, Dennis. Dennis Halliday is former U.N. Assistant Secretary General, and he also headed up the U.N.'s Food for Oil program in Iraq. Secretary of State Colin Powell abruptly canceled an Asian tour today to be on hand for U.N. deliberations on the latest resolution for weapons inspections in Iraq. The vote could occur as early as this weekend. WBAI correspondent Robert Knight has been monitoring the developments at the U.N., and he files this update.
The latest draft was debated overnight by the Security Council, which denied Syria's request to delay the vote until Monday. French President Jacques Chirac says there are still ambiguities to be resolved, specifically on how the Security Council would reconvene in the event of a dispute during a new, more intrusive protocol envisioned in the U.S. draft. The proposal currently establishes serious consequences for noncompliance. Iraq would only have 1 week to agree to the measure when it is passed, and only a month to declare any and all operations relevant to the construction of weapons, a condition that even Chief Inspector Hans Blix says is intractable. But to sweeten the pot, the Bush administration has added new language stating that it recognizes Iraq's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, a frequent visitor to Iraq, is unconvinced on that point.
Well, it's absurd. They're attacking every day. I mean, they have been not only overflying, they've been shooting every day. Overflying is an invasion of the sovereignty of Iraq, and attacking is murderous. The no-fly zone is a creation of the Pentagon. It's not anything that's recognized by the United Nations or in law otherwise, so it's a daily intrusion on the sovereignty of Iraq. Now, they claim that they've been fired on over a period of 11 years, and that they've never fired except in retaliation. Well, hundreds of people have been killed on the ground, hundreds of people, probably more than 100 this year, by these attacks. There's no aircraft of the United States or the United Kingdom with a scratch on it. Nobody's been hit, nobody's been hurt. So if your local police department killed hundreds of people over a period of time claiming they were being attacked, but they never got dust on them, you'd think maybe you had a bunch of murderers on the force, and that's what they've been doing.
The U.S. proposal includes far more intrusive inspection protocols than before, including access to presidential residences.
Can you imagine what we would say if someone said, we demand the right to go, and we've got a few weapons of mass destruction in this country, to go any place, any time, and inspect anywhere. We're going to go into the White House. We're going into your closet, Mr. President. We're going to look in that black bag you got sitting over in the corner there. We're going to go everywhere. You know, we'd nuke them for impertinence. What that is, it's an invitation to almost unavoidable resistance of some kind, so that they'll then come back to the Security Council and say, see, they're not cooperating. It doesn't mean that there shouldn't be inspections, but why is it that in the whole world there's only one country that's being asked to submit to this sanctions regime? Israel's got hundreds of nuclear warheads. We know that. We gave it to them. I mean, we gave them the means to develop it. We gave them the materiel and provided them with rocketry skills and capacities far beyond what anybody in the area has. Why don't you inspect other countries? You can't be serious about peace or about terrorism, if you want to call it that, or anything else, and just single out one minor party that's about as weak as a country can get. I mean, that country is so debilitated from the sanctions that its capacity to hurt its neighbors or anyone else is virtually non-existent. But they've been so demonized that we're afraid we've got Americans shivering in their beds at night, afraid that Saddam Hussein's going to walk in there and strangle them.
In another provision, designed to avoid a veto from Russia, China, or France, the U.S.-drafted resolution now promises an end to sanctions if Iraq cooperates, a point that Clark finds dubious.
There was 8.5 years of inspections while the sanctions remained in effect and while thousands of people in Iraq died each month, the majority of those thousands being children under the age of 5. So it was clear that the inspection regime was used as a justification for continuing the sanctions. And it's easy to do because you keep saying, well, we've looked at that, but we now have a new report that something's changed there. We've got to go back. Someone's just sighted something up in the north. Someone's seen something elsewhere. There's suspicious activity going on over here. It's endless. So it's to say that it's a means of ending the sanctions, which should have been ended years ago because they're genocidal, is fraudulent, is the whole scheme of seeking to coerce or deceive the Security Council into seeming to approve a murderous assault on Iran.
Meanwhile, the debate continues at the United Nations Security Council with a vote tentatively scheduled for Friday. In New York, I'm Robert Knight.
Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has a week to accept or reject the resolution, and rejection would almost certainly trigger a war. At any point after the resolution is in effect, if weapons inspectors report back to the Security Council that Saddam Hussein is obstructing their work, war is all but certain. Colin Robinson is a research analyst with the Center for Defense Information. We asked him about signs the U.S. military is building up for war.
There are a large number of overt and a couple of covert signs that the United States has been readying for such an attack for at least the past 3 months. They include deployment of troops to the region, additional troops to the region. There are two major ground force headquarters that have just moved to Kuwait. There are a couple of aviation battalions from the U.S. Army forces in Europe that have just, helicopter units that have just moved into Kuwait. There's a good amount of speculation that units from Europe, ground units, tanks and mechanized infantry, will be sent this because rotations from Kosovo are being disrupted due to removing some heavy elements. And there's a large amount of equipment being moved.
We heard reports yesterday on Reuters that there were actually tankers being transported to the region.
What you probably heard was the fact that a large equipment transport ship, the U.S. naval ship Bob Hope, has gone through the Suez Canal heading for the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf. Along with the Bob Hope, there is also another ship, the Fisher, and a further fast sea lift ship, the Bellatrix, sailing from the U.S. east and west coasts to the Gulf, loaded with all sorts of military equipment, all of engineering equipment, logistical equipment to support petrol and fuel transfers, all that sort of types of material. The movement from the west coast is particularly interesting because it includes military engineer vehicles that would be used in any river crossing operation, which is extremely likely given that any attack assault on Baghdad would have to confront the Euphrates River, which would probably necessitate a major military engineering operation, including field bridges.
Now, those are the overt signs. What about the covert operations or signs that you're aware of?
What the reports we've been receiving is that beyond those sort of major signs, there's a large amount of military activity all around the region, and the maritime watch operations that coalition forces have been running since the start of the war in Afghanistan are proceeding at a high level. But specifically, there have been reports of the Central Intelligence Agency establishing two field offices in the northern part of Iraq in the Kurdish areas, and that the elite Israeli General Staff Reconnaissance Unit, Sayeret Matkal, is undertaking Scud hunting, missile hunting reconnaissance missions inside western Iraq already. So there is a level, and there are continued reports of U.S., Israeli, and possibly other countries' troops.
Well,
operating.
What about Kuwait? We heard reports that some sort of planes or missiles left Kuwait over the weekend and were responsible for injuring some Iraqis.
I haven't specifically seen that. Specifically seen any reports of that nature. However, Central Command might well have launched or undertaken one of its relatively routine now missions over the southern no-fly zone. In these missions, planes routinely attack Iraqi air defense missile, anti-aircraft gun, or radar sites because the military judges that the Iraqis are infringing the
no-fly zone.
The no-fly zone. Mm-hmm. So that might well be the sort of thing you were talking about. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any reports today or yesterday of no-fly zone engagements, but that's quite possibly what's gone on.
Colin Robinson is a research analyst with the Center for Defense Information. He believes it's more probable than not that the U.S. will engage in a war with Iraq within 6 months. In Texas, it's clear electoral politics are the agenda of an overwhelmingly white majority who are active as a voting electorate. They are Republican, and they are unaware of how warfare affects minorities. That's according to Kwame Anderson, lead MC for the Houston-based hip-hop project Freedom Sold. Anderson recently spoke to KPFT News about the Republican sweep in Congress and how it affects the war agenda.
You're talking to Kwame Anderson, member of the rap group Freedom Sold, and a person who substitute teaches. Well, my father is Sanders Anderson Jr., the great. He is a professor at Texas Southern University. Voting is an integral part of any attempt to change the system as it is today. And I think that, especially with war, I mean, you think about war, there's a lot of people who went to the Army Reserves. I know a lot of people who went to the Army, you know, because, you know, they couldn't find a job that was a good paycheck. They didn't have money for college. They didn't want to work at Circuit City. They'll go do their time in the service, get out, get their little money, and, you know, life goes on from there. Well, a lot of those people are getting sent off to war right now. People still don't care. Oppression is the only thing that we really share. It doesn't depend on who's sitting in the chair. The rich get richer. The poor make it happen. You have a pretty much Republican rule over the government at this point, and that government is pretty much going to push Bush's agenda. Well, it's been no mystery to anyone who's been paying attention that Bush's agenda pretty much has been war, despite a lot of the other problems, such as the economy and education, healthcare, a lot of other issues that are actually probably affecting Americans a little more than the Saddam Hussein. Why look up? The sun's too bright. You got brown and red included. They say black and white, and it don't matter. I think that, you know, and for the Republican government, I mean, you know, look at the racism in America. I mean, what are they thinking? You know, like, oh, you know, like, we're just taking another Dr. Dre off the street. You know, we're just taking another, who cares, you know, about these kids? They need something to fight for. You know, like, I don't think that they relate, but I would say that you need the poor and lower middle class to influence everything else to sort of be, because like when they need the poor people, they'll be at the black churches, they'll be at the Latino events, they'll be there to say, hey, you know, hey, we care about what you do, because they don't want to seem insensitive. But their agenda is going to completely, you know, wipe out a lot of these kids, but I don't think that it affects them directly. And I think that the most important thing for them is keeping their power, where as long as everybody is ignorant, they keep their power. I think the main thing I'd probably, if I had to say anything to them, would just be like, you know, if it's going to be a war agenda, let's make sure that these people get taken care of. Let's make sure that their families can get taken care of. Let's make sure that these kids, you know, that this war can be about something other than, I mean, let's make sure if we have to fight it, if we're going to fight it, are we fighting this because of the fact that, you know, this cat has beef because this dude tried to assassinate his father? Are we fighting it because of oil? Give me some concrete things that are going on about this that are actually going to affect the neighborhood. Because we're not dealing with education, which is a huge problem. We're not dealing with the economy, which is actually a huge problem. We're not dealing with health care, which is a huge problem. So since we're not going to deal with any of these things, tell me what, you know, is going on in the Middle East. What is Saddam Hussein doing that is directly going to affect a lower income family, a lower middle class family? That means we have to fight. We have to go over there. We have to go over there and have a war. I mean, is there any issue that you can think of? Because from what I see, it's only going to affect rich people. And, you know, it's only going to affect the companies. I mean, when Enron fell, how many political ties did they have? If anything, convince me that this war is important. I mean, and I don't want to hear, like, okay, you know, the cat, he killed his own people. But no, I mean, do you really think, you know, like, this war, after we fight it, after These people die after, you know, the chemical warfare sets in, after the loss of thousands, you know, maybe even, you know, millions of lives takes place. It's going to get better for us. It's going to get better, you know, now, okay, you know, it's worth it. You know, if it, you know, prove to me that, and then maybe I'd say, all right, I see where you're coming from. But at this point, I don't see anything that a war is going to do that's going to make me walk into a classroom. I was talking in a classroom the other day where it was a third grade class and the children could barely read at a first grade level. If we fight a war and we win and we're victorious and the Western ends and the credits roll, are we still going to have, you know, children who can't read, children who can't spell? Are we still going to have the education system be more about standardized testing and be more about setting these kids up to be employees? You know, is it going to be more about making sure that the senior citizens of America can get taken care of? Is it going to be important that the health care is not insane, that if you, you know, get shot in the street and you don't have health care, you just don't have to lay there and die? Or if you do get shot in the street and an ambulance comes and get you, you have to pay thousands and $70,000, $80,000 for something you didn't even plan on happening just because that's how health care is? Are these problems more important enough to bypass in order to make sure that this, you know, this war agenda is like the most important thing that we could be talking about at this time? So, just as long as we fight ignorance and fear, the basis of these places, man, just hunt, never can. If there has to be something said for peace, well then, you know, if you're gonna die, what are you dying for? I think the whole idea of peace is to realize that violence begets violence. You know, even if it's not now, even if it's not 5 years from now, at some point, you know, violence begets violence. Think about 10 years ago when we had the Gulf War. Who would have ever thought 9/11 would have happened? Violence begets violence. It's the same people that are getting killed today, the same people that will suffer because of the war, they have children. And those children will grow up with a contempt and grow up with the idea, like, I have to avenge, I have to... Even if Bush runs his four-year term and doesn't get reelected, the damage will be done, you know, and that's just how it is. You know, it's like it all goes in circles. If, you know, destruction now is destruction tomorrow. That's it.
This piece was produced by Jackson Allers of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Music was provided by Freedom Soul. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, the effect U.S. bombs are having on Iraqi women and children, and the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN are all the target of a media accountability campaign. We'll be right back.